We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
This is our podcast from the Election Integrity Network. And it's about all things related to elections, how elections are supposed to work, how sometimes they don't work, and all things that citizens can do to make sure that we have integrity in our elections. And today we are very honored to have with us on this episode of Who's Counting, Don Palmer. Don is a longtime friend of mine. I'm going to let him tell you a little bit more about him. But one of the things to note is that Don is a member, he is a commissioner of the Federal Election Assistance Commission, and he is the former head of elections, well, he can tell you the specific titles, in the state of Florida. And also, he has been the head of elections in the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia. So Don Palmer is an expert on all things related to elections. And with that, I'd like to welcome you, Don. Thank you so much for joining us and talking to our audience about elections.
Well, thank you, Cleta, for having us. I appreciate that. Just for the record, in Florida, I was a director of elections. I served with Secretary Kurt Browning. He was the chief election official. And from there, I went to Virginia to serve as the secretary of the State Board of Elections in Virginia. And that was with Governor McDonnell, who, and I was his chief election official there. So,
you weren't the number one guy in Florida. You were the number two guy.
That's right. When things went south, I was the number one guy. No, I'm just joking.
That's usually the way it is.
Exactly. In the Department of State, the Secretary of State, there's a number of divisions within the Department of State. Mm-hmm. So I'm in charge of elections and the Division of Elections, but the chief election official was Secretary Kurt Browning.
So Don, before you got into election work, what tell us a little bit about your background. I'm pretty sure that you were in the Navy. So talk to us a little bit about your background.
So I was in the Navy. I started off as an intelligence officer and then decided to go to law school. And then I became a JAG. And so I did a significant amount of time in the Navy. And then I got out of the Navy and went into the reserves. And so that allowed me to seek another career. And because I was interested in elections and I was a lawyer, I went to go work at the Department of Justice. And in the voting section, they have there is a division within the Civil Rights Division called the voting section, and that is where all the federal voting laws are enforced. And so that was my first opportunity to work as an attorney in election law. We looked at the statutes like the Help America Vote Act, the National Voter Registration Act, the NVRA, obviously the Voting Rights Act, which is a very important statute. And so you get a picture and a taste of all the different laws that are sort of at the federal level. Well, that voting section enforces those laws. And so if the Department of Justice or the United States needs to enforce that against a state, that division usually will be in charge of that enforcement. And so I served a number of years there.
What years were those when you were in the voting section at DOJ?
That would be the end of 2005 to 2007.
I see. Okay.
Actually, I'm sorry, 2008. It would be 2008 because I left 2008 to go work in Florida just in time for the 2008 election. And so that was my first taste in election administration is when I moved on from the Department of Justice to the Florida Division of Elections.
And then how long were you in Florida?
I was here for a couple of years until 2011, and I went to Virginia. Governor McDonnell asked me to come on board and serve as chief election official with his administration. And so our family made that move back in 2011.
And then after you left from the Commonwealth of Virginia in that position, That would have been what year? Would that have been 2014?
About 2014. Mm-hmm. Went to the Bipartisan Policy Center.
That's right.
There was the PCA, which is the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. There was a number of bipartisan recommendations. And so I served there with John Fortier and the group, the Democracy Project there, mm-hmm. beyond sort of those bipartisan recommendations that came out of that commission. And so I did that for a number of years before being nominated to serve on the Election Assistance Commission.
So talk to us about the EAC, the Elections Assistance Commission. What is the, if I remember correctly, the EAC grew out of the aftermath of the 2000 presidential election and the Help America Vote Act. Is that right?
It is. That is right. I mean, the EAC was part of that legislation that was really, truly the last big bipartisan piece of voting legislation. And EAC is unique because the Congress made it a bipartisan agency, and they made it independent of the executive branch. Even though we are part of the executive branch, there are things that we are independent of the executive branch, and we're bipartisan. And so we truly have a 2-2 split, sort of like the FEC, which is, I believe, 3-3.
Right.
We're nominated. Our names are at least put forward by the majority of the minority leaders of the Congress. And that's unique in the federal government. And it's unique with election agencies, because I think that the Congress really wanted the EAC to be independent of the executive branch, as the Constitution sort of states that it should be. And that's the Congress made that decision back in 2000. I'm sure that was an area of compromise, but it recognizes the federalism of the way our elections are structured. Very local, very decentralized. And with the EAC as a federal agency, but it's a bipartisan commission that has very limited, if no, regulatory authority. It's really there to assist and not to direct or to instruct states on how to run their elections.
So what are the, so you have two Democrats, two Republicans, and then you have to get three votes to pass anything, right?
Well, yeah, you do. And you'd be surprised that, and I've said this since I got into election administration, is most of the issues we face are not partisan in nature.
It's really, right.
How can we make elections run for both sides? I mean, because both political parties, citizens have a stake in making sure our elections can run properly and accurately. And so there are a few issues that occasionally, may come down to two. But generally speaking, we look to find consensus on how we could administer elections and help the states administer elections. And I think that most folks in this field would agree with that it's not as partisan as someone would portray it to be, and that we can get a lot done if we could work together.
So let's go through the list of things that the EAC is supposed to do. What are the areas, the specific areas of work of the EAC? Yeah. What do you do?
So the primary mission of the EAC really is to set standards for voting systems, the minimal standards. Now, these are voluntary, but most of the states have decided to adopt EAC standards or use our labs to test these voting systems. And so we set the standards and then we test and certify voting systems. And so that was the primary thing out of the 2000 election that the Congress wanted the EAC to do, is to provide that stability and standard development and then that testing program where it would be within accredited labs, working with NIST to accredit labs, and then test those voting systems that tabulate the ballots. And we all know how important that is. And that's why I think they wanted the EAC to provide that oversight, that program, not only for the supplement the states that have their own programs, but also for those states that may not have a program of testing voting systems. They said there has to be some minimal standards, and of course it's voluntary, but I think that was the intent of the Congress. We also distribute funds. So whenever the Congress decides to grant security funds or CARES Act money, and for example, in the event of an emergency like CARES Act, we're usually going to be the steward of those funds to distribute that under a formula under the Help America Vote Act. We also collect data and provide a report every 2 years on election administration to the Congress. We get the data from every locality in the country, in every state in the country. And it really does tell the story of the election, at least from a data perspective. And then lastly, we have a clearinghouse department, which really the Congress wanted us to be a depository of best practices. So that if state A wanted to see and wanted to implement a certain procedure, there would be some best practices that the EAC would have on our website, some general information about it. And so we would serve as a federal depository of that sort of information and sharing that those best practices between states and counties.
So I want to go back and talk about, it sounds as though one of the primary areas of work of the EAC is in voting systems. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the last year, well, really longer than that. I mean, that was so interesting to me is now in late 2021, it is deemed somehow you can't speak about any issues or concerns about voting systems. And yet prior to the November 2020 election, there had been a documentary that some people had done questioning the safety and security. The security of certain voting systems. And there was a lawsuit filed by Democrats in Georgia to keep them from buying Dominion voting equipment. And I'd like to just sort of peel all of that away and without any preconceived notions, drill down a little bit about what citizens need to know about the voting systems. When you talk about voting systems, what are all those different kinds of systems you're talking about? Are you talking about electronic poll books? Are you talking about tabulators? Are you talking about systems that actually record the votes? What all are we talking about when we talk about voting systems?
So in the discussion so far, the voting systems, we're really talking about those machines or systems that tabulate ballots. And so those are the systems that count the ballots. And that was the primary mission given to the EAC with the Help America Vote Act. And look, you know, since I got into this business of helping to administer elections, there's always been those that would criticize and, you know, talk about vulnerabilities with the voting systems, perceived or real. Mm-hmm. And I have worked from the very beginning in Florida and Virginia, now at the EAC, to make sure those systems are tested properly, and then we certify them to those standards that are developed. I have to have an open mind, because in this business, there are going to be a lot of folks that believe they know a lot more about those voting systems than I do, and our team. But I would say that we have been testing voting systems, the states have been testing it, and so have localities for a very long time. It really is an overlapping process. It's not just the EAC that might be testing a system. The states may have a supplemental system of testing to confirm what we have found in our labs. And then the localities do testing they should be doing before and after an election. So there's this overlapping of testing. And I'm very proud and sort of, I learned a lot more when I came to the EAC about that testing to the standards. And I was very impressed with what I saw and what I'd heard from our team. And so I would just convey that to the viewers and to the citizens is that there has been a process in place for a long time. I, over the years, have gotten, I say not myself personally, but the Division of Elections in Florida or Virginia, even the EAC has received criticism from all sides on what they believe should be improved procedures in the testing of those processes. And
well, what would be some of those improvements that people think should be made? What would that be?
Well, I think some of them believe that even though we take a lot of steps, for example, to improve the security of the systems, they believe we could do more. Like we could do more, for example. And so that's a system development process. And we talked about the setting of those standards. And we just adopted a new security standard, BVSG 2.0. But I would just say that I understand that it's an evolving process. And like I came to this job and as chair, I want to improve what we are doing. I want to make sure we have an increased oversight of the manufacturers, that we have the top of the line testing. We work with the states to make sure that we're looking at these systems with the resources we have from Congress, and we scrutinize them deeply. But I do think that we could do better, and we have done, with the establishing standards. And now that we have new standards for security and auditability, I think we need to do everything we can to move to those new systems.
And how does that work? Okay, so the EAC has published these, what is it called? VVAG, what does that stand for?
VVSG 2.0.
But what is it called? What does it stand for?
Voluntary Voting System Guidelines.
Voluntary Voting System Guidelines, VVSG 2.0. And those are, we're talking in late November. There's a comment period for those to be, for people to make comments. And then what happens? What's the difference in 2.0 and 1.0?
Well, in a nutshell, I mean, it's been a number of years since we've updated the VVSG. These are the voluntary standards. And it's taken a number of years to get where we are to adopt the new standards. And they include security, you know, how we audit the machine, how we audit tabulated ballots, for example. How do we deal with voters with disabilities? So what are its accessibility standards? So all these improvements in technology, let's say over the last 5 to 10 years, we've been able to capture that with these new standards. So as technology increases, we have the ability now to improve our voting systems across the board. Now, it may take a number of years to get there, depending on how many resources we put into it, how the states and localities are able to transition. But we really have some hope here for new voting systems with higher standards of everything from accuracy and security to audibility, and to make sure we have a paper trail.
Well, one of the things that people seem to be focused on is connecting, is the ability of hackers to access or bad actors to access voting systems and somehow to manipulate the things that are happening inside the system without anybody knowing about it. So talk to us about that.
I mean, look, it's a legitimate concern that many have. And what I would usually respond to them is we have a program that we have in place for the testing of security, and we're even moving on to doing additional penetration testing. But I would say that the hope of VVSG 2.0, the new standards, if we can get them implemented across the country, is that it adds more security for the physical security. It also makes sure that there's no external communication from EAC certified systems to the internet or to a voter registrations, to a voting system, to an office or to some other entity. So we will not certify a system unless that is disabled as part of the testing. And so what that means is that we have set a standard. We can't make all states meet those standards. I mean, it's a voluntary program, but we're trying to do is set those standards and those testing to make sure that there is no external communication from those voting systems.
And so is that statutory? I've noticed that it's the law in several states that the systems are not supposed to be connected to the internet. Is that the law everywhere or just various places?
Just various places. I would think there's about 12 to 15 states that allow for the external communication results. You know, there is a balance there. Many states want to use that external communication because it helps get the results in a more timely manner, and there's no delays in results. On the other hand, you have the security experts that say that it might be, you know, it could be a vulnerability to the system. And so this is an area, like, for example, that it's not a congressional statute. If a number of states want to do it, some have decided not to do it. The EAC has made a decision that if it's going to be an EAC certified system, that external communication capability needs to be disabled or taken out altogether.
So what is the, you know, one of the things that I've heard people say in the last year is that there's the ability of someone who knows how to operate a system to put into a program that's essentially almost like a Word program and manipulate ballots and tabulations and counts and then basically disappears at the end of the day. I'm sure you've heard some of those kinds of allegations.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to respond because you don't know precisely what the allegation is. But I would say,
well, and I'm not a techie, so my repeating of an allegation that I heard, when trying to understand what they're talking about, is my apologies. I know it loses something in the process.
No, I understand. And the thing is that look, I sat down with our folks in the testing and certification program and some experts that know a lot more than this than I do, and I've been doing this for a while at the state level. And I testified to the Senate that, you know, look, we tested these systems. We could not find something that would support those allegations that there had been some mass hack of our voting systems. And I think the evidence supports that. I've also interviewed with Lessons Learned election officials from across the country. And, you know, there were a few anomalies in a few states that we obviously monitored, obviously. But for the most part, there was no evidence that the voting systems were corrupted in any way. And, I stand by that. I stand by the certification that we did and the results from those voting machines.
So, Don, what would you say to people who are concerned that that the market for the development, production, manufacture, ownership of these voting systems? I'm trying to think, are there three companies? Is that the total number of, I know there's Dominion, there's Heart Civic, is that the name of it? And then there's ESS, whatever that stands for. What do we tell people about, because there are some people who say, well, you know, that you have Heart Civic that's owned by a hedge fund, and that hedge fund is owned by somebody who was Bill Clinton's roommate's son. And so there's control there, potential partisan manipulation. What do we say to that kind of assertion?
Well, the way I sort of, and we call them registered manufacturers, and we have more than three. There are some, you like to say there's three or four major manufacturers, but we basically have a number of registered manufacturers. And I think the answer is disclosure and accountability. And you know, we at the AC, we do see ourselves as oversight for the manufacturers. We have a voluntary program. They bring the systems in for testing, but if they do want to be a registered manufacturer, we have a number of disclosures that they are required to make, and those will be on our website. And so that should be our number one thing we do. And as the chair, and as when I came on as commissioner, I think the manufacturers understand that this isn't related to any election, particular election, but I do think that they need to understand that accountability to the American people and disclosures are important. And so I think that we have that relationship where in some ways we're a regulator, but we also want to make sure we have that transparency to the public. And so I hope that answers your question on that.
What are the disclosures that you ask them to make if they want to be registered?
For example, in our old system, the BBSG, there was an ownership disclosure of up to 25%. You know, if there's a 25% owner, now I believe it's going to be either 50 or 75%. So there's going to be more transparency of the ownership of the companies, and we're going to do more audits of those manufacturers and of where they develop these systems. Some of it has to do with the resources and the number of people we have at the AC. If we are so small that we cannot do our duties under HAVA, it's really a disservice to the American people, because the American people expect us to do as many audits as it takes to conduct our oversight role, but we absolutely need the resources. And sometimes there's a debate about what is the role of the EAC in the federal government. And that's why I like to say is that we are an assistance agency. We are there. What money is invested in the EAC will help us conduct audits of the laboratories, of the manufacturers, of their production facilities, those type of things that will allow us to do more of that.
And so how many labs are there?
So, we have two accredited labs. You know, as with the voluntary voting system standards, they are voluntary. That's the key word. Mm-hmm. They have to decide if they want to be in a lab, and then they go through a process of accreditation with the EAC and NIST. And so, you know, it's one of the issues that I did bring up earlier, but it's a small market. Sometimes it's hard to make money as a manufacturer in this business. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a lot of people knocking on the door to become manufacturers of voting systems, right, believe it or not. And, you know, I think that it's like the laboratories as well. How much business is there to support three or four labs? And so, you know, earlier this, I think about a decade ago, we had about three labs. Now we have two. It's all based on the market and supply. Right.
So one comment that I heard from a citizens group a couple of weeks ago, they'd done an analysis of their voting systems in their state and had learned that the voting systems had not, that they were certified in 2013 and have not been recertified since. What would that mean? When they tell me that, what does that mean? They've been certified, almost 10 years ago, but not since. What does that mean?
Well, it probably means that they certified to 1.0, and there hasn't been any major changes to that system. There hasn't been any modifications or changes. Therefore, it hasn't had to go through certification. But this points to a bigger issue, Cleta. You know, the EAC doesn't just want our certification to happen a decade ago and then it just remains stagnant. You know, in some ways, you need to maintain and sort of have an oversight program to make sure that those systems are still operating as tested and certified.
Right.
And so that's an important thing that we're working on at the EAC, is it doesn't just stop at certification. It's sort of an ongoing quality management program. But that does take resources and people to do that, and at least some. You know, the federal government, we can use our resources effectively and really pool them for many states to get a benefit out of it. But we do have to have enough resources to start a program like that. We call it a quality management program, and how we do that. It points to another issue that I wanted to bring up, though, and you can see where I'm going here, is that we have a lot of systems in the field that are antiquated. And they haven't been in a very long time. And states and localities may not be able to immediately update that. But I think if, you know, the common man on the street hears that and they have their own computer or the technology, they go, we really need new voting systems. Just like I need a new computer. And so
that's right.
I think that with VBSG 2.0 and the new standards, we need to find a way with the state and localities and the Congress to find a way to upgrade our voting machines. So we're not worrying about external threats. We're not worrying about the inability to audit a voting machine. These are some of the new hopes and features that are in the new standards, but we can't get there if we can't buy the new voting machines.
Well, you know, after 2000, Congress appropriated, seems like several $1 billion for the states to buy new voting systems. That's 20 years ago. Has Congress appropriated money since then to do that?
So over the last 3 or 4 years, Congress has appropriated just under $1 billion in security funds. Now, some of that money could be spent on voting systems, but most of it was spent to tighten up our voter registration systems, our office networks. Some states did use it to buy voting systems. But you could see it wasn't enough for a lot of the states to purchase new voting systems. And as you know, sometimes the states don't provide that money to localities to buy systems.
That's true.
Sometimes the localities themselves are going to be responsible for it. And so there has been another appropriation of about, I think it was almost $400 million in CARES Act funding. But, you know, that was in response to the pandemic and some of those other things, and not necessarily for voting systems. So you can see where it's a little different than the initial money under HAVA that was spent to get rid of some of the old lever machines and punch cards.
Well, I wonder how much, is it something that the EAC compiles to be able to estimate what it would cost to upgrade or buy new systems? And is there any sort of analysis of which states really need new voting systems because the ones they have are were purchased 20 years ago?
Well, we have some, you know, we've had some initial meetings with some, you know, secretaries of state and localities to sort of, how can we determine, you know, what makes sense from a logical perspective and what is database that we could provide to the Congress and just help explain to them what might be needed in the years ahead.
Right.
Some work to do. I think it's going to be part of our work in the future is sort of, how can we do better to provide, you know, what are the needs of the localities and what are the needs of the states? And as you know, I don't know if you've been following the EAC, but we created an advisory board called the Local Leadership Council.
And what is it called?
The Local Leadership Council.
Okay.
And it's the LLC. It's basically, you know, two local election officials from each state. And we're hoping that they can help provide us, you know, that data on the ground, how the money is spent, how they use it in elections at the county or city and municipality level, and then be as smart as we can in providing that data to the Congress. And it isn't just for the Congress, though. And, you know, this is the thing is the Congress gets a lot of fingers are always pointed at the Congress. You know, my experience is that the state rarely assists localities.
That's right.
Fundamental function. And so it has to be a partnership between states and the Congress to help localities. And look, I don't want to get the answer before we do the study and the investigation. And, you know, I'm sure that the Congress will ask our opinion, but it's like, look, we sort of know what it's going to take to help these localities improve their voting systems. But you can see I think these localities and the citizens, they want to have systems that are more secure, are more easily audible, and they help the locality. They do tabulation audits. They want to make it more accessible for voters and more usable. But the only way we get there is if we can find a way to move forward together on this.
Well, it's one of the things that this is so fundamental. And I know that a lot of people want to point to the voting systems and say that was the problem in 2020. I don't think that was the problem in 2020, just based on my observation and research for over a year. But I do think that that it's important that the technology be understood by the citizens and by the election officials, because one of the things I think that is happening all too often is that the election officials say, well, I just really don't understand this. So we'll just have the vendors be in charge of that. Well, I don't think that's a very good approach. I don't care what business you're in. You can't be held hostage by your technology, but sometimes I fear that that's what's going on. Has the EAC addressed that?
Well, I think that you touch on an issue that probably you and others are seeing is that when you don't have a lot of resources, let's say it's a small county in a rural area, they don't have a lot of resources. They maybe have a few staff. They're more reliant on the vendor or the manufacturer to basically help run their elections. And unless you have professional training involved and more resources to bring on staff full time, they become more reliant on this. And so it's a phenomenon that I've seen at the state level. You know, I've done what I could to mitigate that in the states that I've been. But I think the EAC, you know, we're an advisory commission. We do play a role to make sure that we can assist the states and localities in the ways that they find beneficial, and the Congress agrees in some ways through funding. I think there's ways that we can be part of that solution to help them with the professionalism of that and to give them the resources they need to have more qualified people on staff full time versus relying on vendors. And so you can see the options or the issues that the localities have with this is if you don't have the expertise yourself, you're going to have to go to the manufacturer. If you have the ability to train in-house or to train and get that expertise for the full-time employee, then you're gonna want to do that. And so that's the issues that we face with that. The EAC wants to be helpful with that. It's just going to take more targeted assistance and funding to the EAC to help us help others.
Well, in that regard, I noticed that there are some partners, or I don't know what you really call them, listed on the EAC website of vendors or organizations, entities that are resources for election offices. One of those is the Center for Tech and Civic Life, CTCL, which has now burst into national prominence because of its role as the conduit for all of the Zuckerberg money that flowed from Mark Zuckerberg and his wife through the CTCL to local election offices in targeted places. So talk to us about how does CTCL end up with being listed on the EAC website and as a resource, and sort of what's all that about?
Well, I think that, I think I've heard some of the allegations, but I think that we would all agree and prefer that the Election Assistance Commission provide that sort of assistance. And I think the instance you're talking about is CTCL had a product that the EAC felt would be beneficial to election offices with regards to cybersecurity training. It was a three-part curriculum on basic cyber hygiene. And we've over 1,000 election offices viewed that and got that training. Now, when I looked back at that scenario, it was a product that was available, and we have to make resource choices. Either we commit FTEs and resources to develop our own curriculum, or we could, for example, lease this product, which we did through the 2020 election. And so that training was available through the 2020 election, and it was cybersecurity training. But this, my larger point is I think most would prefer, from a bipartisan agency, that we provide that training to our election officials as an agency. We're supposed to have that expertise and that funding to be able to do that ourselves. And we do it in a fair and equitable manner. I don't want to comment on CTCL, but I would just say that we are aware as election officials of perceptions. And so I just want the EAC to be strong enough to have the ability to have our staff in-house develop that training for our election officials. In that instance, what we did was we bought a product that was available, released a product through the 2020 election on that. And so I think the takeaway for those that are watching in your podcast is that in order for the EAC to provide that product from a government agency that's bipartisan and independent of the executive branch, we need to have the resources to be able to do that. And I think that it's important for both sides of the aisle that our agency be able to provide that product and basically do it on a bipartisan basis. And so so I think that's the takeaway that I hope your listeners would take away from that instance.
Well, I don't see a problem with CTCL providing cybersecurity training, but what ended up happening was that somebody saw, okay, here's an organization that's had access to over 1,000 election officials nationwide. That'd be the perfect conduit for Mark Zuckerberg money. And so, what started out as a good idea, I think somebody took it and took it in a direction maybe that nobody had anticipated would happen.
I actually think that's another opportunity for me to make my case, is that I think that the EAC, most folks have looked at the HAVA monies that have come. It's based on, it's from the federal government. Usually it's a mixture of state match money, and it's really distributed in a fair and equitable manner. And there may be debates about what that size is, but I think that I think we make the case that most folks will be comfortable with the EAC distributing these funds. And so in the future, the EAC can do a lot to help our state and localities with this funding.
Well, I do think that maybe one thing that the EAC might take a look at is there ought to be a little conversation, I would think, with CTCL about, you know, a lot of states are passing laws prohibiting the flow of private money through to election offices. I don't know. It just seems like it just is an odd thing that happened in 2020. That's an anomaly I've never seen before, and I hope I don't see again. But it's just something that somebody was very inventive and found a way to use those government agencies. And I do think, you know, one of the things that I've come to believe very strongly, you've been in the election administration business in two states and now really dealing with it all over the country. I think election offices need to get back to their basics, which is our job is to administer the elections in accordance with the law and to make sure we do it as fairly and honestly and properly as possible. And it's not the job of the local election office to get for voter turnout. That's the job of the candidates and the political parties. And I think there's been a lot of pressure on election offices that somehow they need to be responsible for voter turnout. And I think that is a wrong path for election offices, but you might have a different view. What would you think about that?
Well, I agree in one part. I agree because when I was at the state level, I was getting money to do a whole variety of things within the statutes and regulations, but I was rarely given any money to actually help get out the vote. And it's not our purpose as election administrators.
Right.
But, you know, our job is to sort of support those local election officials who many of those offices need, you know, they need resources at the local level. They need it from their state. And if the federal, if the Congress is able to assist, that's also very beneficial. But I think you touched on that. And I just think that the EAC, when it comes to focusing on the fundamentals, we're really the perfect agency to do that because we're not going to get involved in the big policy issues. We're not going to get involved with a state's the debate over a policy issue or the federal government's debate over some of the larger policy issues. What we want to do is focus on the fundamentals. So whatever state it is, we're there to help make sure we have voting machines that tabulate correctly. They have the resources at the local office to basically recruit and train poll workers. So you see that there's a focus at DAC on the fundamentals and on the basics. And that's why I think that, you know, we should be looked at really as a nonpartisan, bipartisan agency, because that's our real focus.
Don, what, you know, I've heard people talk about software changes and that if a voting system is certified, you know, we're always getting updates to our iPhones and to the software on our computers. And what happens when a system is certified and then there's a software upgrade or a software change or a software glitch that takes place during the elections? What, talk us through how those can be addressed in a way that citizens can feel confident that there's not somebody manipulating behind the scenes.
So if a system needs a modification, a software modification, it's like a compressed certification. So a manufacturer can bring that in. It'll be a compressed sort of review by a laboratory and then approval by the EAC. But we have it in our manuals, and how we operate is that if there is a bug fix or a software update, we can do that in a very timely manner. And so one of the criticisms going back a number of years is that the EAC wasn't flexible or agile enough on that front. But over the last couple of years, we have developed this program and it seems to be working just fine, where if we need software updates and the manufacturer believes it's necessary, then we can get that done in a very expeditious manner.
What about... I've heard some people say to me, well, there were software glitches during the election and the vendor had to go in and fix it. And nobody really knows what happened when that happened. Is there anything in your guidelines about transparency and best practices to make sure that people don't think that there's something going on secretly to impact the tabulating or the voting process?
So if there's ever an issue or an anomaly that takes place in the field, the first line of defense is going to be the state. But believe me, if the EEC is monitoring and we're trying to get to the bottom of it, we may actually get an anomaly report. But in my experience, just like when I was at the state level and when there were some issues in a couple of states in this recent election, the first line of defense is going to be that state elections office, that Secretary of State, because believe me, they're vested more than we are. They want to make sure their localities not having any problems with their voting systems and that software. And then we're sort of trying to monitor that situation. And we only get involved if we're needed. Now, just like I talked about the quality monitoring program, I think there's a role that we can play, after the election or at the request of the state. But again, you know, their personal line of defense is going to be at the state level.
So if there is some kind of, well, let me put it this way. I've thought that it would be helpful to be able to publish sort of a layman's terms. Here are things that citizens can do in their home counties, their local jurisdictions, or in their states to be able to have oversight or information about the voting systems, and I'm all about trying to restore confidence by other citizens in all of the election process. But I think you only do that if people are involved and engaged. And what do you say to people? What could be produced or made available to citizens who may not be technologically proficient, but just basic things that they should know to ask or be involved in? What are some things that people could do? I'm all about giving people things to do, tasks, tools that can help them feel as though that they are empowered to know about and have some oversight of the election system, voting systems in their areas.
A couple of things. I mean, number one, I would try to get to know your local election official and sit down and talk with them in a very respectful manner and just ask them questions. Most of these folks are gonna be ready for the questions and are able to answer and want to have a conversation. But the bigger thing is ask for a tour of the office. You know, find out how they store the machines, how they test the machines, both pre and after an election. Let's, you know, how they might do regular maintenance with those systems. So get involved, maybe get a tour, have a conversation with the staff. Mm-hmm. Official. And then look, if you're involved and you are concerned from an official perspective, is, you know, they have logic and accuracy tests usually.
And tell everybody what that is.
So logic and accuracy test is really the locality is going to set aside a time and place. It's usually a public event. It might even be streamed in some places, but it's going to be a public event where you can come watch them take test decks of ballots and try to, I wouldn't say they're trying to break the system, but they're trying to make sure that it is properly capturing the results, the ballots for different ballot scenarios. And so it's trying to make sure that there is no problem counting the ballots as cast. And so that's going to occur before an election sheet will be announced. It's going to be public. In some ways, some people kind of find it boring, but I certainly don't, but I've been through it and watched it. And I think you would get the sense, and they may even explain the process as they go through it. And they may even let you participate yourself in it. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you actually went and watched these tests, you walk away with the confidence that the system is working as designed. And that's really the purpose of this pre-election audit, what we call a logic and accuracy test. And then after the election, oftentimes the same jurisdiction will do a post-election logic and accuracy test. And so again, they're making sure that the system on that voting piece of voting equipment was tabulating correctly when it, you know, during that election. And that gives you the reassurance that, okay, the system was working as designed, the way they wanted it designed prior to the election. And so usually you can attend both of those as an observer. We also have different parts of the process inside an election office that you may be able to observe. But, you know, I think that watching and learning is valuable, as long as it's done in a very respectful manner. And I think that most election officials, I know there were some problems in 2020. I think that if most people approach this as a civic engagement, part of my civic duties, I just want to make sure that the systems are how do they work in my, how do they work in my county? Mm-hmm. Where, or how are they tested? I think the election official will talk to you. If not the person themselves, then the staff will do that for you. And so I encourage folks to do that.
Do you publish, does the EAC publish a best practices for suggesting that there be these steps that can provide transparency and accountability and oversight? I mean, it seems like what you just outlined would certainly be a good sequence of events. I've been aware of logic and accuracy testing prior to the elections, but you've raised a very interesting point, which is to have a post-election testing, just a confirmation. And that makes a lot of sense to me. Do you publish something like that and urge election officials to do that?
Well, we publish a lot of best practices. And, you know, just for example, I think we just did a couple of products on audits, a whole, you know, basic overview of 2020 and audits. The chain of custody and what are best practices with chain of custody. And look, there's probably 500 products on that website.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure there's something that explains logic and accuracy tests and what are best practices. And so I'm pretty confident that it would be available. And so I really do encourage folks to come to our website and look for those best practices and look, you got to remember these practices are taken from election officials across the country. And so not everything will be in every jurisdiction, but that's how we collected these best practices.
You mentioned that you published some information about audits. Can you give us a little overview of what that is?
Well, it's a multi-page white paper on all the different types of audits that are available for election administrators, for chief election officials to choose from. You know, on this podcast, I couldn't go into all of
right. No, that's a whole separate podcast. We might have to have you back to talk about audits.
Yeah. You can, you know, you could take a look at a voting machine. You can look at the ballots and audit the tabulation of ballots. You can audit the procedure.
Everything.
There are a dozen and more things that you can audit. And look, some states have it in statute, some do it by practice, some. And so we try to put documents together that a new Secretary of State, a new Director of Elections, a new head of elections in the locality to come on board, they can get a sense of what are some of the best practices out there.
That's a great idea. We'll definitely review that. And like I say, with all the talk about audits, we may need to have you come back and talk about audits specifically. But we really focus more on voting systems today. But are there other things that you would particularly like citizens to know about the EAC, ways in which people might be able to help the EAC to do its job, and anything that you would like to add to the things we've already discussed?
Well, you know, I think... one of the big programs we have now is we talked a lot about voting systems, and it really is important. But you know, from a security perspective, our election systems, like electronic poll books, are much more vulnerable to someone trying to, you know, create denial of service or some sort of, you know, try to interfere with a polling place operation. And we're going to create a program to test and certify those systems. And so I think the American people would be you know, they're going to be reassured that those systems are being tested as well across the country. And it's one of the things we're working on now.
Well, I think I'm glad to hear that, because I have heard certainly with the elections in Virginia that just ended and your experience in Virginia using something, I guess, called Veris. Is that right? Or what?
Veris.
Well, why are you laughing?
Well, actually, you know, look, I mean, I probably sound like a broken record. You know, Veris is an old voter registration system that was there before I even got there. It was It was already 5 to 10 years old when I got there. And so what does that tell you, Akleta?
Yeah.
If you want to have better list maintenance and better accuracy in the voter rolls, and, you know, you need to invest in your technology. And there needs to be, I know that Veris is the voter registration system, and it's been, there's certain upgrades, but it's an example of how voter registration systems across the country haven't really been upgraded in many cases since the Help America Vote Act, which is 19 years old.
Oh my gosh. Right.
And there just needs to be investment, both at the state, local, and at the congressional level. And to me, it's an example of Veris is one of those systems that it barely gets along. I think that the localities joke about it with me occasionally. We got through a number of federal general elections, presidential elections. And so in some ways it's done its job, but it's an example of where we need to invest and refresh our technology. We can't be stagnant in this area. It's a fundamental part of elections, and it may not be, you know, sort of the glossy policy debates, but it's the fundamentals of elections. Just like in the military, you had good tanks and aircraft, you can win wars. They need to be up to date with the latest technology. You can't, to have our best elections, we got to use some of the newer technology.
Well, are there companies that are manufacturing new products that would replace Veris?
It's not necessarily I would say, yes, there are. The issue is not, is there a product out there? The issue is whether or not Commonwealth of Virginia has the resources to make that sort of investment in a new voter registration system. But, I don't want to preach too much, but I just think it would just do wonders for the administration of elections in the Commonwealth to have a new voter registration system. It's definitely a commitment of resources. I know there's competing interests, but it's the type of thing that we need to look at and invest in elections.
I don't know, you may or may not know this off the top of your head, but just for frame of reference, is a new voter registration system, is that a $5 million investment? Is it $100 million? What's the range for something like that?
I'm putting on the memory card here. When I was in Virginia, I think it was between $10 and $15 million to build a new one. I assuming all things equal with inflation, I bet it's 15 to 20 million at this point.
Well, you know, the legislature and the governor's budget in June in Virginia, the state election office had asked for, I think, $400,000 for public education on the changes in the laws that the legislature had made this year. And they ended up getting $5 million. That's quite a jump from asking for $400,000 and getting $5 million. But none of that was for systems or equipment. It's the kind of thing that, going back to the issue of what's the role of the election office, it was encouraging people to do Sunday voting. Well, for some people, that doesn't seem like the highest and best use of resources in an election office. I'd rather see them cobble together the money to do what you say, buy a new voter registration system. But and there was a lot of money that flowed from Congress to the states through the EAC, as you said, through the CARES Act, that was supposed to be for costs related to COVID. And I don't know. Is there any way to know how that money was spent? Do you get reports, the EAC get reports as to how that money was spent?
Yes. Both security and CARES Act grants, we receive periodic reports. And we also do audits of those. We do periodic audits. I think we just announced 7 states a few months ago. And so each year, the states, a number of states will be notified that they're going to go through an audit. And we have our inspector general will contract to begin those audits with states. So, you know, for example, I was in Florida and Virginia, and we went through audits for HALVA dollars a number of times. And so the public can be assured that, there are auditors that look into this money, as well as the Congress. I'd be surprised that the number of reports that states and the states were required to provide on the use of those funds to the oversight committees within the House and the Senate. And so in some ways, elections gets a lot more scrutiny than other departments and agencies within the federal government, believe it or not. Those grants are, and it's not just to make sure we're steward of government funds, which is very important, but also to see the types of things you're being spent on. Is the Congress realizing the investment that they've made? There's a lot of folks that monitor this, and we have to explain a lot what the data, what they're seeing. But you'd be very surprised at the oversight and the monitoring of those grants.
Well, I'm a very big believer in oversight and monitoring and auditing of government money, of tax dollars. It's not the government's money, it's our money. So I'm a big believer in that. But is there anything else that you'd like to mention today about the EAC and about your work? Like I say, I'm going to go drill down on the audits, and we may have to have another conversation about audits, but anything else you'd like to share with us today?
Now, the last thing I'll leave is we do focus a lot on election officials, and we also focus on the voter. In HAVA, you know, we do have a duty to the voter, and that's where we become a trusted source of information. And so we're not the largest agency, but we do encourage people to read our materials, not just election officials, because we think that because we are the only federal agency that's focused on election administration and supporting election administration, that voters are going to want that information and they want it to be available at a federal agency website.
Well, I have used information from the website. It's extensive, and I'm sure you would welcome anyone and everyone coming to the website, looking at reports going back 20 years, many election cycles on all kinds of information. So we appreciate your service. We appreciate your service to the country and the military, and your service as a civilian in the field of election administration. You're one of the national treasures, in my view, and a real expert in this field. And you've always been so willing to help anyone who needs it and to share information. And we really do appreciate that. And thank you so much for joining me today on my podcast, Who's Counting? And we'll look forward to having you back and go study up on that audit part, because I think we're going to need to be talking about that. And that's it. That's the end of our podcast for today. Thanks, everybody. And we hope you'll join us for the next episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. Thank you.
Thank you, Cleta.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Editing is by 39 Bravo. Please help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth, because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, and to become part of the Election Integrity Network.